I'm wondering about impartiality of judges. I know that we go through great lengths to make sure that juries are as impartial as possible, especially for high-profile cases. I'm wondering if there's any effort to make sure that judges are impartial when it comes to high-profile cases as well.
After 2 weeks, dozens of witnesses, and testimony from the defendant, Cal Rittenhouse has been acquitted of all charges. This comes after he shot 3 people and killed 2 in Kenosha, Wisconsin last year. Throughout the trial, Judge Bruce Schrader's conduct has thrown a spotlight on himself and our legal system. He's the judge who presided over the case. It's raised tough questions about the role of judges, how they're appointed and elected, how they're assigned to cases, and how they're disciplined. We're answering your questions about judges and taking a closer look at the process that gets them a seat on the bench. You're listening to the 1A Podcast. I'm Jen White. And remember, to join future conversations, just download our app, 1A Vox Pop, and leave us a voicemail. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Grifols. Senior Director of Corporate Affairs Vlasta Hakes explains the science behind the plasma-derived medicines the company produces.
Plasma contains proteins and antibodies. There are people who are missing those antibodies, or they're missing a protein that helps their body function. And what Grifols then does is we collect this plasma and then isolate those proteins and antibodies to produce a medicine.
To learn more about donating plasma and to find a Grifols center near you, visit grifolsplasma.com.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
We're answering your questions about judges. Joining us now is LaDoris Hazard Cordell. She's a retired trial judge for the Santa Clara County Superior Court. She's also the author of Her Honor, My Life on the Bench, What Works, What's Broken, and How to Change It. Judge Cordell, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Also joining us is Keith Swisher. He's a professor of legal ethics at the University of Arizona College of Law. Professor Swisher, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jen. Pleasure to be on the show with you and Judge Cordell. Thank you.
So, Judge Cordell, I want to start by getting your reaction to the Rittenhouse verdict.
I wasn't surprised by the verdict because in Wisconsin, the burden is on the prosecutor to prove beyond a reasonable doubt or to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt that Kyle Rittenhouse acted in self-defense. This is unusual because in most states, the burden is on the person claiming self-defense to prove that that was justified beyond a reasonable doubt. So I wasn't surprised by it at all. The jurors, once they believed Kyle Rittenhouse, really had very little choice other than to find that he acted in self-defense. So this trial was all about the credibility of Kyle Rittenhouse and the ability of the prosecution to cross-examine to undermine that credibility, and they did not do that.
Professor Swisher, what about you?
I would say that I wasn't exactly sure how it would turn out. I agree with the judge that I thought it was more likely that perhaps that he would be acquitted, but I didn't think it was a sure thing at all. There were some really perplexing questions about, three people were shot, the first, unarmed, and it just wasn't clear to me, but for the reasons that Judge Cordell mentioned, I wasn't completely surprised by the self-defense verdict.
Now, throughout the trial, Judge Bruce Schrader has attracted a lot of scrutiny for his behavior on the bench, from banning the use of the word victim to describe the men Kyle Rittenhouse shot, to the way he instructed the jury. And Professor, as a legal ethicist, what's your impression of Judge Schrader? Where do you draw the line between quirks and misconduct?
That's a good question. Thank you. So judges can be disciplined, suspended, removed from office, reprimanded for their conduct. They do get a fair amount of leeway, though, in presiding over the courtroom and keeping sort of a hopefully orderly and efficient but also fair trial. There are different places you can draw the line. For example, judges aren't allowed to berate witnesses or parties or use racist language, as some have done. So there are various places that a judge can be disciplined, but with the general sort of note that they're allowed a fair amount of leeway in keeping order in their courtroom.
Now, we should say Judge Schrader's ban of the term victim isn't just limited to this case. What does that tell you about how he approaches certain defendants?
That's a good thing if it's not limited to the case, perhaps. The judge wouldn't be alone. There are, of course, other judges across the country who don't use the word victim or limit it. It's sort of assuming the conclusion. A lot of the trials are about, or partly about, whether the person is indeed a victim. And so for that and other reasons, some judges limit the term. But it would be particularly problematic if a judge just did it in this case to, say, hamper the prosecution. But applying it evenly and hopefully fairly in other cases, it might be a good sign here.
Judge Cornell, what about you? What was your assessment of Judge Schrader?
I found his conduct of the trial to be appalling. I found that he just displayed so much bias in favor of the defense. It was very disturbing. Every judge, first of all, every state has a judicial code of conduct, and Wisconsin has one. And there's a principle or a canon in the Wisconsin code that says a judge shall be patient, dignified, and courteous to litigants, jurors, witnesses, lawyers, and others with whom the judge deals in an official capacity. And it says a judge shall perform judicial duties without bias or prejudice. This judge crossed the line so many times. You've pointed to some of them, but I'll even start with saying that the victims could not be called victims in this case, but they could be called looters, arsonists, and rioters without any information about that they indeed had engaged in looting or rioting. And he could have said protesters. He didn't allow that. And arsonists. So there's bias right there. In addition, he did a lot of yelling in the courtroom and berating only of the prosecution lawyers. He made his own objections for the defense. He advised when in just before giving jury instructions, he said in court that he gave advice to the defense and said, you shouldn't argue too long about self-defense because the jury might get a little bored by that. That is absolutely outrageous. And finally, there's an optic, one of them that I saw, where Kyle Rittenhouse is standing up at the witness stand and leaning over, and the judge is leaning over as if they're looking at something, but they are very close in proximity to one another. All of these things, the judge's verbal and nonverbal behavior sends a message to the jury that this is a good kid, I like him. And those kinds of messages do have an influence on juries when they are looking at and trying to decide the credibility of Kyle Rittenhouse. And here, clearly, they believed Kyle Rittenhouse. They did not consider the fact that he's a liar, that he was not a medic when he claimed to be a medic, that he had no business having the gun, those kinds of things that I think really went to his credibility or lack thereof. But the judge's conduct belied all of that.
I want to turn to the trial out of Georgia. The judge in the trial over the killing of Ahmaud Arbery has also attracted scrutiny. Judge Timothy Walmsley has identified intentional discrimination in the jury selection process, but he allowed the trial to continue. Judge Cordell, how much discretion do judges have when it comes to that jury selection process?
Well, jury selection is very interesting, and the judge, indeed, just as you said, found that when the prosecution was excusing jurors, using peremptory challenges where you don't have to give a reason, the judge found that their explanations, when they were pushed to give a reason, were, even though they were quote-unquote race-neutral, meaning they didn't say, well, we got rid of all of those Black jurors because they were Black, the judge still said, I found that that was intentional discrimination. But why didn't the judge do anything after that? Because Georgia law just says, if you mouth the words that are race neutral, the judge really doesn't have the ability to reinstate the jurors or find that there was intentional discrimination and then remedy it. So I mean, it's just very disconcerting that the law says that and limits a judge in being able to find a remedy.
So a judge can say, I see discrimination happening. Does that then give prosecution or defense attorneys some fodder to perhaps go to another authority and say, this process has been flawed?
Sure. I mean, so there is, if there is not an acquittal, because once there is an acquittal, it's done. But if there's a conviction, then, you know, there can be an appeal. But on this and this one, it's just really unclear. I mean, there are things that I think the lawyers should be calling out right there in court to make a record, to absolutely say that these things are happening and they're wrong. Again, on this one, this is a different judge in the sense that he's not as blatant with his bias. And I can't say that, you know, this is a biased judge. He's just not behaving the same way as the judge did in the Rittenhouse case.
Now, Professor Swisher, I want to get into some basics, starting with how judges come to sit on the bench. First, when are judges elected and when are they appointed?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it does differ across the country. We often hear about the federal model where they're appointed essentially for life. On the states, the vast majority of judges, however, are elected. Now, that does vary to some extent with the states, but the two states that we've been talking about, namely Wisconsin and Georgia, judges sometimes are appointed initially or often are appointed initially by the governor, but then they run in nonpartisan elections thereafter. So in short, the vast majority of state court judges are elected by the public.
And when judges appear on a ballot, when are they required to run as a political party affiliate and when are they not?
That's split too, with most being nonpartisan. So they don't, the voters don't see, for example, an R or a D or an I next to the judge's name when they vote. Not true in all states, but that's primarily the case. And it was the case in these two states that we've been talking about.
That they ran on a nonpartisan ticket.
Yes, that's correct. That's right.
And what's the range of term limits for the judges we elect?
It's a great question. So that too varies by state, from 2 to 10 or higher even in some states. Both of these two was 6, which is about the norm. And 4 to 6 is most common that I've been seeing.
Judge Cordell, you were a trial judge for nearly 20 years. How did you first come to sit on the bench?
I was first appointed by then Governor Jerry Brown in the early 1980s. And then I decided to run for a higher seat. At the time in California, there were 2 levels of trial courts. They are consolidated today. That happened in the late 1990s. So there's just one now, Superior Court. But at the time, I was appointed to the municipal court and then ran for a vacant seat on the Superior Court, was elected to that seat. I just want to make a quick comment about the judge who gave you, who chimed in on this. I couldn't agree more, but let's understand that we're talking about trial courts. Every state has appellate courts. These are judges who review decisions of the trial court judges. And it's the trial court judges who have the pressure in making these decisions and doing them very, very quickly and making hundreds of them sometimes a day. Appellate judges can sit back, they can reflect, they can take 60 days or 6 months to make a decision about a case. But trial judges maybe get 6 minutes and sometimes 60 seconds to make decisions all day long. So it's really, really important to understand that distinction. And there are about 37,000 trial court judges across the U.S. And in those courts, there are about 80 million new filings a year.
And Professor Swisher, what kind of experience does a judge have to serve as a trial judge? Let's just start with that court.
Great. Yeah, and they do face additional pressure. They have to make quick decisions. Peremptory challenges was one issue that came up a moment ago. And I'm glad Arizona, for example, is getting rid of those because they allow the parties to exercise bias on the basis of race or sex, among other bases. And so that's something to look into. And that's something that trial judges face every day. And so particularly, though, what was your question in particular on trial judges?
In particular, I'm wondering what kind of experience judges have to sit on the bench.
Sure. So it's fairly minimal. They do have to have practiced law in most states. There are some exceptions of lower court judges who don't need to be licensed or don't need to have been former attorneys, but most do need to have practiced law for a period of years, typically at least five or more, be of a certain age, but typically they all are. And indeed, I agree with the judges. Judge Cordell's point. I mean, they work very hard. I mean, I have respect for most judges greatly, but they do differ from the general public. They tend, because of these requirements or whatnot, they tend to be a bit older. They tend to be a bit richer. So there are some important distinctions there. But in terms of a sort of uniform level of experience across the country, there really isn't. Besides, typically, you have to have a license to practice law.
We're answering your questions about judges. Remember to have your questions answered on future topics or just to let us know what you think. Tweet us at 1A. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp, the online counseling service dedicated to connecting you with a licensed counselor to help you overcome whatever stands in the way of your happiness. Fill out a questionnaire and get matched with a professional tailored to your needs. And if you aren't satisfied with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time, free of charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/1A to get 10% off your first month. Get the help you deserve with BetterHelp.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
Now let's get back to your questions about judges. Judge Cordell, how does a court determine if a judge has a conflict of interest in a case? Who makes that call?
Generally, it's the lawyers who will raise it and say, Judge, I believe there's a conflict. Or the judge is required, if the judge realizes that he or she has a conflict, to raise it him or herself. So it's up to the judge to either say, no, there's not really a conflict, or to say, since there's a conflict, I'm going to step aside, and then the presiding judge will assign the case to another judge.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, the judge overseeing the case is the person who makes the call ultimately of whether or not they can preside?
Yeah, that's what happens. And if the judge disagrees with a lawyer who says, Judge, you have a conflict, then the lawyer can immediately, for example, take a writ, which means just an immediate appeal to say, I don't want to go forward because there's a conflict here, and have an appellate judge or judges look at that and make a decision. But yes, it's less up to the judge to decide whether or not to recuse, which is meaning stepping aside, recuse him or herself.
Did you ever recuse yourself from a case because of a conflict of interest?
I may have. I'm trying to think. There may have been an instance where I had a case where I knew one of the witnesses or maybe a defendant in the case. And if you know someone, then it's time to step aside, because you don't want a judge to come in with any preconceived notions about the witnesses or any of the litigants in a case.
Take us inside the mind of a judge. What is it like to have that kind of power over what happens in a case and ultimately someone's life?
Being a trial judge is, in my view, it's the worst and the best of jobs. I had wonderful days, and I had some really bad days where I had to make decisions that I didn't agree with. And by that, I mean that judges are required to take an oath to uphold all of the laws of their state and the laws of the federal constitution. And there were laws, for example, the three strikes law in California when I was on the bench was the most harsh of all the three strikes law in the country. And I didn't support that law. I thought it was just wrong to paint everyone with the same brush, which is what mandatory minimum sentencing laws do. But yet I had to impose it, even though I disagreed with the law. So it's really, really hard to remain independent and objective. And also there's a concern some judges have that if they make a decision that's lawful but controversial, that they could, for example, in some states, one of them California, be recalled, meaning people could just say, oh, I don't like what that judge did, even though it was lawful. And then that judge has to look at a recall and fight to maintain the job. And that's what happened recently in California with the recall of Judge Aaron Persky.
We also got this tweet from Catherine who says, if jurors have to be non-biased, one would think the judge also needs to prove they are not biased for a particular case. Can they be removed or recused from a case? And we got into some of that already, but specifically around this question of bias, Professor Swisher, how is that handled where judges are concerned?
Yeah, it's a problematic area. The states are, I hope, trying to improve in this. But as Judge Cordell had mentioned a moment ago, it's often the judge who's claimed to have a bias that's deciding whether the judge themselves have a bias. You can imagine that's concerning to the public. Justice is supposed to be fair, but also appear to be fair. And so some states are moving toward, some already have, and some states are moving toward a system where it's not the biased judge determining, or the allegedly biased judge determining whether they actually have a bias or not. They're sort of judging their own case. And then, as Judge Cordell mentioned, sort of forcing the litigants to appeal if they refuse to get off the case. And then, you know, litigants are, you know, fearful because then they feel like if the judge doesn't get kicked off the case, then they might have some retaliation from the judge for not stepping off. So I think it's important the states move to a model where you can get review by a neutral judge as quickly as possible. Now, judges try to be fair and objective. They're bound to be, and most do. But as the Supreme Court noted in the recent Williams case, I mean, bias, it's easy to attribute in others, but very difficult to see in yourself.
Studies
have backed that up.
You're referencing a Supreme Court case. Can you explain a bit more?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So there was a case where this head prosecutor had okayed the death penalty for a defendant. And then, as you know, death penalty cases, they typically percolate in the system for years or decades. Well, in the meantime, this DA had been elected to the Supreme Court of the state of Pennsylvania and presided over it's not sort of the terminology in appellate courts, but served as an appellate court justice when this criminal defendant's appeal eventually worked its way up that high. And, you know, perhaps not surprisingly sided against the defendant. And as I think many of us noted, I mean, the judge should have stepped aside from the case. And I think most would have, but he didn't. So the Supreme Court had to step in and say that that was a violation of the defendant's due process rights. But it never would have made it that far, potentially, or if there had been stronger sort of recusal or disqualification procedure in place. I know many states are thinking about it. I would urge them to continue to think about it. The procedure here is weak when it comes to viewing judges' conflicts.
Can I just jump in real quickly?
Sure, Judge Cordell.
And just say that there is a difference between a conflict of interest and bias. So every human being on this planet has biases, everybody, including judges. And what judges have to do, and there are some states that are giving trainings for judges, is to recognize their biases, because many of them are unconscious. They're just this the way they are because their life experience has given them these biases, to recognize the biases and then set them aside when they're hearing a case. And if they cannot do that, then that's the time for the judge to say, I just can't be fair in this case. That's different from a conflict of interest. So, and just a quick example, I had a case come before me where two young white males were charged with vandalism. And when I looked at the case, I saw that they had burned a cross on the lawn of a family, a black family in San Jose, and painted KKK on the side of the house. So I had to stop and say, can I be fair to these two young men? They didn't have prior criminal records. I made a decision that I could be fair and presided over the case, but I had to really think about it. So bias different really from conflict of interest is, as I said, say an attorney has a buddy of yours or has given money to a campaign that you ran on. Those are the kinds of things that I think differentiate conflict from bias.
Judge Cordell, that makes me wonder whether there's even an informal system for judges to perhaps do that kind of gut check with one another, or if judges are just sort of insulated from that kind of helpful critique that can come from the outside.
Right. Judging, especially the trial judges, it's a very, very isolating experience. That courtroom is your courtroom. Nobody else tells you what to do in that courtroom. Now, that doesn't mean that trial judges don't talk to one another. They do, some don't. But it is very isolating. And it's part of this, again, is just internally coming to the realization that you have a bias and trying to be as honest as you can before presiding over a case. But there are trainings. So in California, there's a judge's college where I taught there for more than a decade, judicial ethics and conduct, where we tried as best we could to address bias and to make judges aware that we all have biases and recognize their own before deciding whether or not they can fairly and objectively preside over a case.
Now, a Reuters investigation from last year found that thousands of local and state judges who broke laws or oaths remained on the bench. Judge Cordell, what might insulate a judge from accountability?
I have a chapter in my book called Bad Judges, and I write about that whole process about disciplining judges. I also have an appendix, listing every single state and the District of Columbia where you can click the link and find the disciplinary body in your state and also read about judges who have been disciplined. The disciplinary process, in my view, is not transparent. The public really has very little knowledge or information about what happens to judges. And in many, many instances in many states, there are complaints about judges where the complaints are dismissed by these bodies. And the great majority of cases, judges who are complained about are not disciplined. I believe that once we have a transparent system of discipline in every state, that will start to change. Again, this is an area that the public really doesn't know much about because these proceedings are kept really in private. And I'm advocating to have all of these proceedings where judges are actually brought up on disciplinary proceedings to be made public, live streamed, and open to everyone.
Well, here's another message we got from Joanna in Colorado.
I practice in Golden, Colorado, and I have practiced for 22 years in Chicago and in courts all over Colorado. I have also interviewed to be a judge 2 times and had the honor of attempting to be on the bench. My main comment on the judiciary is I would love to see more diversity of experience. There's a propensity to appoint a high, high percentage of criminal attorneys. I think we need people who understand family law, elder law, probate, real estate, commercial transactions. And when you have 80% of judges that are criminal, you end up with decisions that don't really reflect the equities or the law in business, family, probate, elder law. So my main goal would be to see more diversity of experience on the bench.
Judge Cordell, briefly, what's your response to Joanna? Because this alludes to something you said earlier.
She makes a very good point. Most trial court judges are former prosecutors. And that's really the path to getting on the bench in a lot of states. The governors or legislative bodies that appoint want prosecutors. That's changing, for example, in California. More public defenders are being appointed, but still that's in the criminal system. And your caller is absolutely right that when there is more diversity of experience and diversity of background and race, ethnicity, gender, you get a judiciary that's more experienced and understanding of the various types of cases that come before them. So I couldn't agree more. And it really, however, takes lawyers to apply for these judgeships. This caller did. She's applied twice. I hope she does not give up because she makes a good point that we really need more diversity of experience as well as gender, ethnicity, and race.
We got this tweet from Charles who says, even where judges are appointed and confirmed, governors often use them as ways to reward longtime politicians. Professor Swisher, in 4 years, former President Trump appointed 3 Supreme Court justices, 54 federal appellate judges, and in the process, he flipped the balance of several appeals courts from a majority Democratic appointees to a majority of Republican appointees. What's your sense of the relationship between politics and the judges and whether partisanship is playing a bigger role?
Yeah, it's a great point. Partisanship certainly does play a role. There are systems, like for example, the merit selection system for appointing judges was part of it. The design was to hope to remove politics more from the judicial selection and retention systems, but it still filters in. I mean, in the states, it's often the governor or occasionally a legislative body making the appointments. They are partisan actors, and the caller was worried that sometimes friends or acquaintances are appointed. Yes, that does happen. I mean, I wouldn't say that's necessarily the majority of the time, but certainly judges play this very impactful role in their jurisdiction, and governors and other appointing authorities see that, and they try to put in someone whom they like.
Well, we'll have to leave the conversation there for now. We've been speaking with Keith Swisher. He's a professor of legal ethics at the University of Arizona College of Law. Also with us, LaDoris Hazard Cordell. She's a retired trial judge for the Santa Clara County Superior Court. She's also the author of Her Honor, My Life on the Bench, What Works, What's Broken, and How to Change It. Judge Cordell, Professor Swisher, thanks for speaking with us. Today's producer was Catherine Fink. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk more soon. This is 1A.